Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. New York Governor Kathy Hochul signed a new law allowing small distilleries, cideries, and makers of mead to ship directly to consumers. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley with more.
For nearly 20 years, wineries in New York State have been able to ship their product directly to consumers. The bill signed by the governor on Monday extends that ability to craft distilleries and cideries. New York Farm Bureau CEO Deanna Fox says it has been a multi-year effort to get the direct-to-consumer shipping bill enacted.
The economic impacts look to be allowing cideries and distilleries to keep more of their profit in their pocket. They're not having to rely on a middleman to market, distribute, ship their products. They can do that direct on their own websites. It also just allows them to maintain more of a direct avenue for sales to the consumers that appreciate those products. So they're able to sell hypothetically more product and therefore boost their bottom lines.
New York Cider Association Executive Director Scott Ramsey says the new law recognizes the emergence and importance of small distillers, cideries, and growers in the agricultural economy.
We're talking about apple growers across the state who are producing New York cider. You know, we're a leader in the industry, and so this allows us to expand the already $1.7 billion total economic impact we have to the state into something that's even more meaningful and more impactful, not only to the state, but to their local communities.
Nine Pin Cider Works of Albany was the state's first farm cidery, founded in 2013. Co-owner and general manager Sonia Del Perel says the new law will allow them to reach consumers where distribution is unavailable.
We have a lot of very small farm-based cideries that don't necessarily get distribution, and we play a very important role in the state's agritourism industry. And we have people coming through, visiting our tasting rooms, who really like our ciders, and they leave. They're unable to find the ciders. And, you know, it's also a consumer choice issue. The modern day consumer, frankly, does a lot of online shopping, and it's a whole new channel of trade for our industry.
During the COVID-19 pandemic, the distilleries and cideries were given temporary permission for direct-to-consumer sales. Del Perel believes that was critical to passage of this permanent law.
The old arguments against this tended to be that we're going to negatively affect the distributors and the retailers. And so this executive order provided like an experimental period, and the collected data show that there was no negative effect on the distributors and retailers during that period of time that shipping was permitted.
According to data provided by the New York Farm Bureau, as of 2023, there were 276 licensed distillers and 18 licensed meaderies, and as of 2020, there were 125 licensed cideries in the state. The new law takes effect in 90 days.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
The Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Authority and New York Racing Association are celebrating what they say is improved equine safety. The Legislative Gazette's Aaron Schellel-Levine reports.
HISA was founded in 2020 to establish a unified set of regulations for the racetracks across the United States. 2 years later, racing's first federal regulator's racetrack safety regulations went into effect. And in May 2023, it implemented an anti-doping and medication program. According to HISA, the fatality rate for racehorses has dropped for four consecutive quarters, resulting in a nearly 50% decrease over the past year. CEO Lisa Lazarus says she expects the trend to continue.
Quarter after quarter, we've been going down. And so that's really encouraging. It's not obviously just HISA. We've got tremendous support from the horsemen and the veterinarians, and I think it's really been an industry initiative working together. But while it's, you know, still too early to take a victory lap, the numbers and the data are really encouraging.
HISA says deaths fell from 1.48 racing-related equine fatalities per 1,000 starts in the first quarter of 2023 to 0.78 fatalities per 1,000 starts in the second quarter of 2024. Lazarus says the new safety regulations look at three buckets: surface conditions, anti-doping policies, and health.
You know, veterinary protocols, inspections, more veterinary eyes on horses, more technologies around things like PET scans, and emerging technologies that help us diagnose and catch equine injuries before they really develop into something more serious. And so I think in that bucket, you're going to see, you know, more introduction of these new technologies, more reliance on some of these scanners, and integration in sort of the day-to-day.
The organization has completed accreditation visits at 31 tracks across the country, including Aqueduct and Saratoga Racecourse in New York. HISA uses data on more than 40 risk factors to determine which horses on each race card need the most immediate attention from on-hand vets. Lazarus says having a national organizing body prevents horses with out-of-state records from falling through the cracks. Longtime trainer H. Graham Motion says that the industry is better off with HISA than without it.
I've been in the sport 30 years, and I think my biggest gripe has always been that every state has different rules. So it'd be like if you were in the NFL and every time you traveled out of town, you'd be playing under different rules, which would be almost impossible. You know, we train in Maryland. I run in a lot of different states on any given weekend, and that made it very difficult to follow. Now under HISA, we are all under a national standard set of rules, which is actually much better for all of us in the long run once everybody gets used to it.
Spokesman Pat McKenna says NYRA is committed to long-term safety improvements.
Now, just more than a year into HISA's regulations being the law of the land in terms of thoroughbred racing, again, those equine fatalities, those serious equine injuries, continue to decrease. And that is obviously welcome news.
In 2023, 17 horses died at Saratoga Racecourse. The New York State Gaming Commission finds 9 racing fatalities was a sharp increase from 2022's 3 racing deaths. A Gaming Commission report authored by the Office of Equine Medical Doctor Scott Palmer suggested that while a number of factors contributed to the fatalities, track conditions were the most significant. Saratoga Racecourse was closed August 9th as the remnants of Tropical Storm Debby battered the region. McKenna says improvements to safety remain a priority.
So that turned out to be the right call, but as we see increasingly, at least here in upstate New York, those kinds of extreme weather events continue to impact not only horse racing, but outdoor events, outdoor sports in general. So we will continue to obviously make decisions in the best interest of the safety of racing participants, fans, as well as the 1,000 or so employees who are here on the property each and every day.
Motion supported the rain check.
I think this was a great move, and I think it does show a new attitude, and I think a lot of this has been brought about by HISA. But compliments to the NYRA for making that decision. They were looking at for the safety of the animals and the jockeys over their pocketbooks, if you like. You know, there's a lot of pressure on these racetracks on these big days because certainly that's when they're able to make their biggest income through the betting handle. So yes, I do think this is going to be a change in policy.
McKenna expects this summer's meet to continue the 10-year trend of attracting upwards of 1 million attendees. So far, 3 horses based at Saratoga Racecourse have died this year. Reporting for the Southern Adirondack Bureau on the campus of Skidmore College, I'm Aaron Shello Levine.
Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week, I sat down with Judy Patrick, vice president of the New York Press Association, and we talked about the Local Journalism Sustainability Act passed by the legislature in this year's budget that would set aside $90 million to subsidize local news for the next 3 years.
Well, it certainly will be helpful. We're still waiting to see exactly how it will work. I think the Empire State Development Corporation is the one who is coming up with the exact rules about how it will work. They talk about Sustainability Act. So whether or not this will put more reporters on the street is up to each individual paper or news organization. How the money will be distributed hasn't been determined at this point. Who's qualified? You know, are small local radio stations, are bloggers qualified? I think those are the kinds of things that need to be resolved at this point. And also, the news organization can use the money, not necessarily for reporters, they can, or they could use it for a new software system or, you know, to bolster their sales staff, to innovate in different ways. So it's up to the papers. What I think is important for us to do is to track this, to see how the money is spent, who gets it, and do what we do all the time, is to hold ourselves accountable to make sure the money is spent and truly helps local journalism. It's only a 3-year program, remember. And so what do we do at the end of the 3 years is another issue. So it can't hurt, but I think our challenge now is to watch and see what happens and to see that the money's well spent.
We're speaking with Judy Patrick, the vice president of the New York Press Association. You can find out more at newyorkpressassociation.com. Judy is also the former editor of the Daily Gazette. And for those of you on WAMC, you know her from the Roundtable and the Media Project, where we talk about these specific issues, including this one. But I'd like your response for our Capital Connection listeners, Judy. The New York Times announcing no more political endorsements. Now, this is strange to me. I know many don't like this idea, although many of us might agree that endorsements, how much impact they have, I don't really know. And does it really matter? What do you think?
Well, whether or not it matters, I think, may be beside the point. As you recall, most newspapers in the country did not endorse Donald Trump in his run for presidency, and it didn't seem to make a difference. But it does make a difference in terms of the media's responsibility to be engaged. And the New York Times deciding not to endorse at the state and mayoral levels in their realm, that seems like an abrogation of the responsibility. Maybe they don't need to endorse in every city council race or the assembly and senate races, but they have an important role to play in the community, and it seems like they're stepping away from it. A lot of local newspapers still endorse candidates, and it's a lot of work, I'll concede. My newspaper that I worked at 40 years or so, most of the years I worked there, we did not endorse. We believed, the publisher at that time believed, that we should leave it to the voters to decide, or the citizens to decide who they should vote for. Who were we to tell them? But over time, I've realized that people who cover the news, who read the news, whose job it is to stay on top of the news, they come to these decisions with a heightened level of wisdom, again, and experience. And I do treasure their opinions. And so I'm sad to see New York Times step away from this, and I hope they reconsider.
Well, let's talk about something that's very frustrating for journalists. And that's when we want to get information from public officials and we file a FOIL request. This is the Freedom of Information Law.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just one of these things where the law really has no teeth, does it?
Oh, if I'm talking to editors across the state, this is their biggest frustration. And as you remember, when Kathy Hochul took over as governor, she promised transparency in New York State, that she was going to have all of her agencies file transparency reports and to reply to FOILs as quickly as possible. That hasn't happened. State government remains very inaccessible when it comes to securing information, and local governments as well. Paper after paper, they file FOILs, Freedom of Information requests, and they wait and wait and wait. And by the time the FOIL is received, the request for information, it could be what's happening with this contract or what's happening with a budget. By the time they get the information, it's too late to run the story. The issue's dead. There are a package of bills before the legislature every year, it seems, to fortify the Freedom of Information request, to require tougher deadlines, and to install some penalties if local governments and state governments do not comply with the Freedom of Information request on time or in a timely manner. I mean, papers are waiting months, sometimes even years. I I've had situations where the reporter has gone and left to another paper by the time the Freedom of Information request has been returned. You know, the city of Niagara Falls, for example, has been trying for months to get some information from the city of Niagara Falls about how much money they've spent on eminent domain acquisition of land for this new Centennial Park that they're building, and they haven't gotten the information. There's story after story across the state. The challenge for the local papers is trying to get this information. Their only recourse is to go to court. To go to court, they need to hire a lawyer, and hiring a lawyer in many cases means that they're going to have to take money out of their newsroom budget, which means fewer people on the street asking questions, and they can't make those kind of decisions.
And Judy, the politicians know it.
They know it. They're calling our bluff. They're saying, we know you're not going to be able to go to court, so we're just not going to file it. Now, there are some resources available, like Cornell Law School. They have a First Amendment Center, and they have resources for papers, especially in the metro area and on Long Island, that will help them file those, what we call Article 78s in Supreme Court, to challenge the denials of Freedom of Information requests. But that shouldn't be the case. The law should make it easier for us to get the information to which we are entitled.
That's Judy Patrick, Vice President of the New York Press Association. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The Rockefeller Institute of Government hosted the last of five public hearings on New York's foundation aid formula for funding education late last week. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas was there and filed this report.
Education officials gathered at Gilderland High School to air their views before a listening panel on revamping the way New York State distributes funding to school districts. Foundation aid was first enacted in 2007. The formula decides how the state distributes aid to districts based on a number of factors. New York Governor Kathy Hochul proposed changing it this year before it was restored by state lawmakers during budget talks. United Federation of Teachers President Michael Mulgrew testified the current formula is outdated and not fiscally sustainable.
The schools have become much more of the social safety network for each community. That was never the intent. When I was growing up, the school was there to teach you your academics so you could move forward and develop you as a person. It was never intended to be the social safety network that has now become everywhere. And this is what we are facing. There is a fear that this process is about figuring out a way to cut school funding. Well, let's just put this out there. Okay? We do a lot of advocacy. We work with our members to make sure that they understand that they're not alone, that they're facing these challenges. We are all doing this together. But this foundation aid formula change needs to be done, and I don't think that's in dispute anymore by anyone.
Bob Lowry spoke on behalf of the New York State Council for School Superintendents, imploring that state aid formulas should treat similar districts similarly.
It is true that most of our districts have experienced enrollment declines, but virtually all are now doing more than ever before to help students and families with problems beyond academics. That's been the number one theme when we ask superintendents what is most important for New Yorkers to understand about their public schools today. The actual cost of foundation aid, save harmless, remains small, accounting for just 1% of total school aid and less than 0.3% of total state operating funds disbursements. But the impact of cuts can be catastrophic for affected districts. Offsetting the proposed cuts this year would have required local tax increases averaging 5.1% on top of whatever was needed to meet cost increases. Action is needed on behalf of students attending districts which have experienced steep enrollment declines to ensure that they have access to opportunities we would want for our own children. But abrupt, drastic cuts in aid for their schools can only diminish their prospects.
Jennifer Pyle, executive director at Conference of Big Five School Districts, said there is a need to overhaul the pupil needs index.
The current foundation aid formula targets state aid to high-need school districts via the calculation of the pupil needs index. The community poverty data embedded is again captured from the 2000 census. It's extremely outdated and fails to accurately account for shifts in population. The state must construct a new formula that's not only reflective of current community demographics, but most importantly, one that will continue to utilize inputs that are dynamic in nature and adjust to our ever-changing population shifts. Each of the Big Five, as I'm sure you're well aware, are heavily reliant on state funds. The large city school districts have no ability to raise local revenues given their fiscal dependency, and our districts, Albany, Mount Vernon, and Utica, are of course limited by the tax cap imposed upon them.
Now that the hearings have concluded, the Rockefeller Institute will prepare an evaluation of the foundation aid formula. EdTrust New York Executive Director Arlen Benjamin Gomez testified in New York City.
They definitely seem receptive to understanding what needs to be updated in the formula. Again, the politics of budget and money and education is not always receptive to the idea that it actually costs. We have to invest in education in order to see the outcomes we want.
New York State United Teachers President Melinda Person tells WAMC that in the end, the students are paramount.
Some of the initial conversation about this study was really around how do we fund the formula? The state constitution says that we will provide a sound basic education for all children in the state of New York. It does not say that we will provide it if the state can afford it.
The Institute's final report is due for presentation to the Senate, Assembly, and Governor Hochul in December.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
The stalled construction of a bridge along the Harlem Valley Rail Trail in Columbia County has created tension between local business owners and New York State officials in recent months, as shops and restaurants say they're missing out during the crucial summer tourism season. As the Legislative Gazette's Jesse King reports, one local brewery owner may call it quits before the project is complete.
It might be too noisy in there, so if we want, we can go out to the patio or somewhere.
Okay, thank you.
So, this is our restaurant.
When Steve Bluestone bought the historic Hillsdale Mercantile Building on Anthony Street in 2018, it seemed like a chance to get in early on a good deal. The warehouse, which had sat mostly empty for years, was across the street from an isolated 2.4-mile section of the Harlem Valley Rail Trail that, he thought, was about to be connected to the larger trail running more than 20 miles south to Wissahick. He had heard that the state office of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation had plans and funding in place, and he envisioned a perfect spot for a brewery where summer bicyclists could park, ride, and grab a beer at the end of the day.
You saw what happened to Millerton.
Yeah.
Millerton, just 20 minutes south of here, the rail trail got built and it touched into the town both directions, and every vacant store filled up.
Yeah.
And they're still full.
Yeah.
And they're busy.
Yeah.
Bluestone opened Rojam Brewing Co. in 2020, and earlier this year, his friend Kevin Hines opened up Twisted Sisters Coffee House next door. Both men now worry they got in too early because the bridge connector has yet to be built.
Kevin's had a busy day today. We get busy days, but then there's quiet days.
Yeah.
And the rail trail, occasionally you see some bicycles going. So we do get some bike traffic,
yeah,
but not nearly as much,
yeah,
as we could if we had more than, because 2.4 miles is nothing on a bike.
For months, Bluestone and other business owners have been trying to get an answer from state officials about why construction has stalled. He shows me a letter he received in April from Regional Parks Director Linda Cooper, saying the state still needs to finish a review process and acquire the trail section from the Harlem Valley Rail Trail Association before it can put the project to bid and hire a contractor. Phil Meeks, the board director of the HVRTA, gives me a different answer. After years of bureaucratic hurdles and delays caused by the COVID-19 pandemic, the state no longer has enough money to finish the job, the price tag for which has inflated to about $4.5 million.
The Harlem Valley Rail Trail Association, as well as state parks, is not pleased with how long it's taken to accomplish what we want to accomplish. It's complicated. Most of those tactical situations have been resolved. So the design work has been resolved. The land transfer is all but resolved, and that should be resolved in the next couple of weeks. And the remaining factor, which is a big one, is we have a funding shortfall. So we have a funding shortfall of a little over $2 million to begin the project.
Late last week, Meeks and Cooper met with local officials and business owners, including Bluestone, to give them an update. Meeks says there will be more communication going forward, but he's hesitant to provide a specific timeline for the bridge, as they're still working with New York lawmakers to secure the funding. Long term, he says he's focused on changing the way HVRTA and the Parks Office collaborate on these projects to speed up construction. The HVRTA hopes to one day extend the trail as far north as Chatham. Matthew White, who owns multiple businesses in Hillsdale, including the Hillsdale General Store, says it's a frustrating situation.
I think folks who don't own and run brick-and-mortar businesses cannot remotely comprehend the challenges we face. And in a community, a rural community with no infrastructure, this is what I would call infrastructure.
For Bluestone, a former developer and contractor, the news is disheartening. Rodram Brewing Company is his retirement project. He and his wife poured millions of dollars into preserving and retrofitting the 19th century building, earning a New York Historic Preservation Award in the process. Their craft beers are brewed in-house, they built an outdoor beer garden during COVID, and often host live music. Bluestone says he and other business owners even donated to the bridge project years ago. How much, though, he wouldn't say. But now there's no bridge, and the brewery has yet to make a profit. He's not sure he can hold on much longer.
We're not announcing, we're not officially doing so. Although if anyone listens to your story and wants to buy a brewery and a restaurant, come on in. I'm ready, I'm done, you know, but I'm not done.
In a statement, the State Office of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation says it is working diligently with the HVRTA to push the project forward. In the meantime, the office says bicyclists can use Route 22, a state bicycle route, to get between the two sections of the trail. The Harlem Valley Rail Trail is expected to connect to the Empire State Trail eventually. I'm Jesse King.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org. Look for program number 2434. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.